This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. Washington Wise from Charles Schwab is an original podcast that unpacks the stories making news there. Listen at schwab.com/WashingtonWise.
It's launch day for Instacart's long-awaited IPO. Plus, U.S. consumers now owe more in auto loans than student debt, and how Europe's quest for energy is reshaping the global gas industry.
It's a facility that is in the middle of the Sahara Desert of Algeria, surrounded by armed Algerian military personnel, and the Italian energy company that runs the facility is drilling dozens of wells in the desert to provide as much gas as possible to Europe.
It's Tuesday, September 19th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Oil prices have reached fresh highs this morning as traders weigh up supply constraints and a prediction from Chevron CEO Mike Wirth that prices will return to $100 a barrel this year. Commodities reporter Joe Wallace has been watching the price action and says that crude has further room to run.
Brent crude, the global benchmark, is at about $95 a barrel. That's its highest level in about a year. Many traders and analysts think $100 a barrel is the next stop for Brent. There seems to be a one-way train for now. Saudi Arabia and Russia are really constricting global supplies by cutting production and exports to plump up their revenues. And at the same time, there's record levels of demand for oil globally. A lot of people don't think we'll see the highs of last year being tested, $140 a barrel for Brent. For OPEC and Saudi Arabia in particular, there is this balancing act that they want higher prices, but they don't want prices to rise so high that it really kills demand. So it is possible to ease off a bit.
Grocery delivery company Instacart is just hours away from debuting on the NASDAQ. In a further sign of resurgence in the IPO market following chip designer Arm's successful listing last week, Instacart plans to offer shares at $30 at the high end of its target range. Journal Capital Markets reporter Corey Driebusch told us that while investors are more price sensitive than in the IPO boom days of 2021, the $242 million profit that Instacart generated in the first half of this year could boost its appeal.
Interest rates and inflation have been going up, making other and quote-unquote safer investments like bonds just more attractive. And also high growth companies just have become a little less attractive to investors. If you're going to put money in a company, you want to see profits more so than 20 or 30% growth year over year with no profits. So Instacart has been trying to go public for the last 2 years. When they did decide to go public this year, they have profits. And even though maybe they're not growing at such a fast speed as they had been during the pandemic, they just are a much more stable looking company, according to a lot of investors that we've spoken with.
At $30 a share, Instacart will be valued just shy of $10 billion, a far cry from the $39 billion valuation that it commanded during a funding round in 2021. And President Biden and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky are set to speak today at the UN General Assembly's annual meeting in New York. However, with a number of prominent world leaders sitting out this year's event, foreign policy reporter Will Malden said that others could steal the spotlight.
One headliner that will be there is Iran President Ibrahim Raisi. This comes in the middle of a prisoner swap between the U.S. and Iran involving the unfreezing of $6 billion approximately in oil revenue for Iran. And of course, there are concerns about its nuclear program.
Tensions over Iran's nuclear program are on the rise. Over the weekend, the head of the UN's atomic agency rebuked Iran for preventing a number of inspectors from working in the country, leading to U.S. and European calls for Tehran to re-engage with the agency. Coming up, unexpected new winners are emerging in the global energy war. We'll visit some of them, plus get an update on auto strikes after the break.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From waters off the coast of Congo to the blistering sands of the Sahara, Europe's scramble for energy security is breathing life into once obscure corners of the energy world. Journal reporter Matthew Dalton has been documenting this rapid redrawing of global natural gas flows. Matthew, when you report booming activity in some far-flung places from Azerbaijan and Algeria to Congo, take us into what that actually looks like on the ground.
Well, I went to Algeria for this story, and I went to a place called Bir Rebba, which is about 500 miles southeast of Algiers, the capital, in the middle of the Sahara Desert of Algeria. And you have to fly for about 2.5 hours on a little plane to an airstrip in the middle of the desert. And it's a facility that is surrounded by armed Algerian military personnel. These are strategic national facilities for Algeria. And for a long while, Algeria was kind of losing market share to Russia and the European gas market. But since the war, Europe has been desperate for getting new sources of gas. And this facility is a hive of drilling activity now. There are drilling wells all over the desert. And the way that it works is there's a facility, basically a big oil and gas processing plant in the middle of the desert. And then the workers go out dozens of miles into the desert to drill wells where surveys show that oil and gas should be located. They sell the oil, they put the gas into pipelines that are hundreds of miles long that take it up to the Mediterranean coast and into Italy and into Spain, and now increasingly into the rest of Europe.
And this is just one example of where this is occurring, as far south as Congo, as far east as Azerbaijan. Gives you a real sense of how this push by Europe is awakening gas production all over the world. But I have to ask, given the fact that this is still such early days, how much energy security can these facilities really offer? I mean, why weren't these sources of energy being tapped previously if they were so readily available?
Well, the short answer to that question is Russia. Because Russia had a dominant position in the European market. They kept prices low as a commercial strategy, pushing other suppliers to more or less out of the European market. Russia's natural gas exports were part of Moscow's strategic policy towards keeping Europe on its side. Now, what's been happening over the last 18 months since the war began is Europe was looking for supplies that could be quickly brought to market. So in the energy industry, it takes 5 years or more from the start of a project to when the gas or oil starts flowing. Europe didn't have that kind of time, so they needed to find gas where it could be brought quickly to market. Now, one of those places is Algeria. You've got huge reserves, and you've got the infrastructure already in place. And what they just need to do is go drill in other places around the existing infrastructure. And that's true for the other places you mentioned. Azerbaijan has a big natural gas industry. And then you had this interesting situation offshore Congo, which is where Eni for years had been injecting natural gas into a cavern underneath the sea because it was basically a byproduct of the oil facilities that they had over there. So Eni was looking around the world and they said, well, we have all this natural gas sitting in a cavern underneath the sea, and we're going to pump it out and put it in liquefied natural gas tankers and send it largely to Europe, but also to the global markets. So you had a bunch of different things that Europe was able and European companies were able to bring online pretty quickly.
Okay, so it does seem from your reporting that Europe has succeeded to a large degree in reducing its dependence on Russia. Its current 13% reliance on Russian gas imports is way lower than the 45% before the war. But does that mean Europe is fully out of the woods as winter approaches on the continent?
It's not out of the woods. First of all, 13% is still a significant amount. If Russia were to turn that off today, that would be a big problem for Europe. It wouldn't be as big of a problem as the problem that they had right after the war started, but it would still be significant. And then there is this worry that Europe is replacing Russia with other suppliers that are potentially also unreliable. You have Algeria, which is actually a close ally of Russia. They are one of the largest purchasers of Russian military equipment. They have a relationship that goes back decades. But then after I went to Algeria and I spoke to some of the officials there, I get the sense, the very strong sense, that Algeria is not going to carry water for Russia when it comes to selling natural gas. Natural gas is its primary source of national revenue. It is what props up the Algerian government. And so they are not going to forego revenue for the sake of any kind of political alliance with Russia. As the Algerian energy minister said to me, we have political ties and friendship, but business is business.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Dalton. Matthew, thank you so much for bringing us this story.
Thanks, Luke.
To Canada now, where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the country is investigating credible allegations of Indian government involvement in the killing of a Sikh independence leader in Canada in June.
Canada has declared its deep concerns to the top intelligence and security officials of the Indian government. Last week at the G20, I brought them personally and directly to Prime Minister Modi in no uncertain terms. Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty.
India's foreign ministry has dismissed the allegations as absurd and motivated, accusing Canada of sheltering extremists linked to a Sikh separatist movement. Such a public allegation of one nation conspiring in an assassination in another country's sovereign territory is unusual and is likely to darken relations between two countries with traditionally strong ties. Canada recently suspended talks with India on a liberalized trade agreement, and the trade minister last week canceled a planned trip to India. The United Auto Workers Union has warned of expanding strikes against Detroit carmakers, despite talks between both sides resuming yesterday. In a video last night, UAW President Sean Fain warned the union will target new plants by noon on Friday if companies don't improve their proposals.
We're going to keep hitting the company where we need to, when we need to. And we're not going to keep waiting around forever while they drag this out.
We've learned that a particular sticking point for the union revolves around a proposal by Jeep maker Stellantis to possibly close 18 U.S. facilities as part of a potential labor agreement. The automaker has said it doesn't plan on cutting jobs, but instead aims to reduce its real estate footprint. And auto loans have raced past student loans this year as the second largest debt burden for U.S. consumers. According to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Americans owe about $1.6 trillion in auto loans, surpassed only by mortgages at $12 trillion. WSJ Pro reporter Bob Fernandez says the threat of a slowing economy and higher unemployment is adding to the debt load.
The Fed's rate campaign has softened the labor market modestly and could lead to job cuts and higher unemployment in the future, which would stress consumers and auto loan borrowers. Moody's Analytics data shows that the last time the rate of auto loan delinquencies was this high was around April 2010, after the financial crisis. A top Ford executive warned over the summer that a higher unemployment rate correlates to more auto loan delinquencies. And next month, federal student loan payments resume after the COVID pause, adding to the budgeting woes of consumers who are dealing with inflation, auto loans, and other expenses.
And finally, do you remember that viral image of the Pope wearing a puffy white coat? If so, you probably know that it wasn't real and was instead generated by AI. As AI generators have gotten good enough to make images that are convincingly realistic, tech companies are working on ways to prevent us from getting duped. Andrew Jenks is the director of media provenance at Microsoft and says its Bing AI generator now includes an indelible mark in the coding behind images that are generated by AI from the moment they're created.
What that actually means is that we're adding the technical indication that an image was created by that generative AI system. We believe it's important that we tell you that it came from the Bing service, when that happened, and some identifying information that lets you know what model it was. My hope is that you can tell which ones were created and which ones were captured so that you continue to have a relationship with reality.
To hear more about the race to stop the spread of fake images, check out the latest episode of the Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. And that is What's News for Tuesday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bullivant and Mohsin Ali. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.